The new science of epigenetics is changing our understanding of heredity, identity, and disease. On today's edition of Please Explain, we'll find out how environmental factors can alter the way our genes function and what new discoveries might mean for understanding and treating things like cancer, obesity, and neurological disorders. Joining us now are Dr. Dana Dolinoy, who is the Searle Assistant Professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan, and Dr. Randy Jertl, Professor of Radiation Oncology at Duke University. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Dana, let's start by first defining in as simple terms as possible what the epigenome is and how it's related to the genome.
Sure. So epigenetics literally means in addition to or above the genome. So you can think of it as the layer of regulation that's on top of our genes that tells them when to turn on, where to turn on, and even how much to turn on. Sort of like a dimmer switch in one's house. You have many different switches, and you can raise your lights high or you can keep them low and dim.
Now, this is a relatively new field of science. When did the study of epigenetics begin?
Well, epigenetics, and especially how the environment and how nutritional factors impact the epigenome, is a relatively new science, although we have been investigating the epigenetic mechanisms in cancer for a number of years. But the field of environmental epigenomics has really gained a lot of momentum, and it's even invaded popular culture. It was present in Michael Crichton's book Last. It was also used to help solve a crime on Special Victims Unit Law and Order a couple of weeks ago. So it's definitely invading popular culture.
Right. What kind of environmental factors are we talking about here?
Probably just about any environmental factor that you can envision has got the potential of altering the epigenome. The ones that we particularly have studied are chemical substances, for example, like nutritional supplements, vitamin B12, folic acid, those types of things. And also Dana, actually, when she was in this laboratory, looked at compounds like bisphenol A, which we're all exposed to because it's used to make plastics. And we even have evidence now that things like physical agents like ionizing radiation also potentially alters the epigenome.
Well, you're a professor of radiation oncology at Duke. Can't radiation cause mutations? Is that something that fits into this?
That's the way radiation is thought of as acting primarily, and at high levels of radiation, that's primarily the mode at which it causes problems. But at very low doses, which we're all exposed to, in particular, like for example, when we fly, and I fly a lot, you're exposed to a lot more low-dose radiation than when you're down at ground level. Those low doses of radiation also can alter the epigenome. And from the results that we have right now, it looks like it's not always potentially harmful.
Well, high-dose genetic mutations are permanent. Are these epigenetic changes permanent as well?
No, that's the beauty of the epigenome from some perspective is that they're potentially preventable, and they're also very potentially you can erase them. But the downside of that from some people's perspective is that it introduces a responsibility.
Dana, what is methylation?
Well, methylation is a modification that occurs at DNA. So we know that DNA is a genetic code made up of molecules called bases, and there are four bases. They're called C, T, A, and G. And at certain bases, in particular bases that are the C form, there can be methylation. And this is just a quartet of atoms that is comprised of one carbon group and one carbon atom and three hydrogen atoms. And this group can go attached to the top of the cytosine and can act like a regulatory molecule. And it helps turn genes off, and when the methylation group is removed, it can turn genes on.
And, of course, when genes are turned on, we wind up with cells growing fast. That can lead to cancer?
Yeah. I mean, when genes being on or off can be positive or negative. It's really context dependent. So if you have a gene such as an oncogene that's turned on, that's not necessarily a positive thing. But if you have a gene such as a tumor suppressor gene, which can become methylated and turned off, that would also be considered a negative thing. So methylation can be both positive or negative, and it really depends on which gene is affected.
Aren't there other ways of genes turning on and off as a result of the way DNA is folded?
Sure. So DNA methylation is one of several epigenetic mechanisms, but the genetic material must also be compacted into the cell. So a second epigenetic mechanism are the molecules in which DNA is wrapped around in order to fit inside the cell's nucleus. And these are things called histone modifications or even small RNAs.
What's the difference between an expressed gene and an imprinted gene?
Well, expressed genes, there's a lot of genes that are expressed, and usually when we inherit a gene from our mother and father, when they are expressed, they're expressed from both copies, the one that's inherited from the mother and the one that's inherited from the father. But there's a small subset of genes, probably around 200 genes within the human genome, that are expressed always only from one copy, and that copy is always from the mother or the father, depending upon the gene that you're talking about. So in effect, with those genes, we've lost a backup. So now a single mutation or even a single epigenetic change, because the silencing of that one copy is epigenetic in origin, can totally disrupt the function of the gene. So they become susceptibility, as we say, loci or positions within the genome for diseases.
And that's part of what your research on agouti mice is all about?
Not the agouti mice. Those are not imprinted genes. That's a gene that can be expressed from both copies, and depending on what happens very early, you either have one copy, no copies, or two copies functional. So it's a bit different system there, but it's along the same lines in that epigenetics is involved in regulating also these genes.
You were able to change a mouse's offspring by changing its diet.
That was work done with Robert Waterlin when he was in the lab in 2003. And we know that there's a lot of evidence for what's called the fetal origins of adult disease susceptibility. And in humans, the natural studies that have been done that show this clearly in humans is at the end of World War II, when the Nazis put an embargo against Holland and there was a severe famine, and about 60% of the children, for example, that were in utero at that time died, but 40% were born. They were found to have small stature, and interestingly, then the next generation, they were shown to have increased incidences of obesity, diabetes, cancer, and interestingly, also a 2 to 3-fold increase in schizophrenia. That was also reproduced in China in the late 1950s, early 60s, and basically the same results were found. But what we didn't know...
I just want to stop you for a second. But that's no longer the case in the Netherlands. So is this just a one-generation thing, or does this get passed on to the offspring's children in some
cases? It appears with the children that it gets passed on. So we now know, at least in animal models, that memory system is epigenetic, and that's what the agouti mouse experiments showed us. We don't know that absolutely in humans, but it appears that the children of the children, basically the grandchildren, also have increased incidences of these problems. So there is a legacy that appears to be passed from generation to generation.
My guests are Dr. Randy Jertl, professor of radiation oncology at Duke University, and Dana Dolinoy, a Searle assistant professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences, the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. We're talking about epigenetics on today's Please Explain here on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. And later, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Dana, there seem to be a lot of epigenetic effects caused by diet. Is it becoming more obvious that what we eat matters a great deal, not just to our own health, but to the potential health of our children?
Yeah, it does. You just heard from Dr. Jertl about different nutritional exposures, but we've also begun to look at various environmental exposures, things like exposure to bisphenol A, which is the building block of certain plastics, and others are looking at things like phthalates, which are also in plastics, and other compounds that are called endocrine active compounds that can mimic the biological steroids such as estrogen, which are in our body.
What about things like folic acid? Is that an example of a supplement that protects developing fetuses?
Well, we know we have the United States and other countries supplement our grain supply with folic acid to help protect against certain types of birth defects, and this has been a highly successful public health campaign. But what we don't know is whether supplementing the whole population, especially older individuals or younger children, is beneficial. And there are some that argue that this might not necessarily be a good thing because, as I explained earlier, methylation can be good or bad depending on which genes it occurs at. So if you're methylating genes that you want to turn that you want to be on and they're becoming turned off, this might not be necessarily be a positive effect. So yeah, you can view folic acid as a double-edged sword.
Randy, how much of the studying is being done of identical twins who have the exact same DNA? Do we see epigenetic changes in them as they get older?
Yeah, definitely. That's been shown already by Dr. Esteller, who was in Spain, where he showed very clearly that identical twins do not have the same epigenomes, and the divergence or the splitting of the epigenomes between identical twins becomes greater and greater as people age, and particularly when they're in completely different environments. So again, it's an environmental effect that you're seeing on the epigenome.
Twins who are identical throughout childhood sometimes begin to look quite different as they get older. That's because of the epigenomic impacts?
It's possible. I mean, there's other things that could be doing this, but one major component will be epigenetic changes. They're not identical, and they're not identical from the very beginning from the standpoint of the epigenomes. The epigenomes are really, I think of the genome as being comparable to the computer, the hardware of a computer, and the epigenome being comparable to the software that tells that computer when, where, and how to work. So what we're talking about right now is the programming of the cells very early, and that program can be very different between one identical twin and the other because the marks that are laid down at that point are different themselves.
So are epigenetic changes the reason that one twin might develop cancer or Alzheimer's disease or asthma while the other one remains healthy?
That's definitely a possibility, and I think a real possibility.
Dana, you work in the field of public health. What kind of epigenetic research do you do?
Well, we're beginning to look at, based on some of our previous work in the Agouti mouse model, we're beginning to look at whether exposure to bisphenol A at different time points, either during development or during adolescence, can change the epigenome. And we're trying to do this in order to figure out what genes in the human are particularly important, because up until now, we've really been focused on animal models, and we know that the epigenome in these animal models might not be exactly the same as the epigenome in humans.
Would you say that the majority of epigenetic changes occur in utero?
I would say that the developmental time period is particularly important, but it may not be the only important time. There are other changes, physiological changes during lifehood. We know that the epigenome changes with aging. We know that certain genes are programmed to become methylated when you age because you need them turned on when you're younger and you need them turned off when you're older.
So Alzheimer's, for example, would that be the result of changes in the developing fetus or when somebody is older?
It's possible that it could be both, and those are some really important questions that people at Michigan are beginning to investigate.
A listener, Lucy in New York, asks regarding the famine in Holland, would the children of women who suffer from severe morning sickness in the first trimester have the same epigenetic effects as the children in Holland?
Whoa. Because of a famine is what you're talking about, and reduced amount of nutrition.
Uh-huh.
It's incredible. I had never actually really thought of that, but it is possible. It's the famine itself that's reducing the amount of folic acid, and the methyl groups that Dana was talking about, all of those groups that ultimately, let's say, bind onto the DNA directly, all come from our food. So things that disrupt food intake have the potential of reducing the amount of methyl groups that one can put down very early in development. I don't know. It's not been looked at, but it is a very interesting idea.
Now, we mentioned earlier that folic acid can have a positive effect. Are there some foods that we know have a negative effect?
Boy, I don't think anybody. Dana, do you know anybody?
Well,
feeding mice, really bad
question.
Cookies?
Because I think it depends on the dose.
Right.
You know, the dose is the poison. So we've, in the agouti model, the agouti mouse model, we've also studied genistein, which is the major phytoestrogen that's in soy, all soy and soy products. So in that case, when we fed the mouse mothers genistein, they had a positive effect. It was much like feeding them a lot of methyl donors like folic acid. We had a lot more lean brown mice. So in that context, it was a very positive effect for the mice. We also know that people living in Asian countries consume a greater amount of soy and that they might be better protected from certain cancers like breast and prostate cancer. So it is possible that that something like genistein could be positive, but you might not want to load up on a whole lot of genistein because it is an estrogenic mimic. So if you have too much estrogen in certain periods of your life, that might not necessarily be a good outcome.
How does understanding epigenetic processes help in treating cancers? Instead of destroying healthy cells as chemotherapy does epigenetic science allow us to develop drugs that treat just the single gene that's been turned off?
Not a single gene, but there are small molecules that are called that, like histone deacetylase inhibitors, for example, is one compound or groups of compounds that that result in altering the epigenome, and they call it epigenetic therapy. So what they're really doing is targeting these methyl groups and different histone marks that are present to open them up, for example, so the tumor suppressor genes that are inappropriately turned on now function. And it's sort of thought of as being sort of diplomacy, what you're doing now, and you use lower levels of these compounds so they're not toxic to the individual that are being treated this way. And you're trying to coax these cells into becoming social, or if they're not going to be social, to undergo what's called programmed cell death or apoptosis and kill themselves so that they're no longer around.
Would that also work theoretically as a way of treating HIV/AIDS?
I'm not sure about that, but it's potentially another way of maybe treating, for example, or preventing, I think, ultimately, some neurological disorders. But we're way in our infancy in those types of studies.
But, you mean like autism?
And possibly schizophrenia, because if you can get people through these developmental points, and they are to some degree caused by epigenetic changes, and I think particularly in these imprinted genes that we were talking about before, and the brain, quote, develops normally, you might not have problems for the rest of their lives.
Isn't there evidence that obesity is due to epigenetic changes and type 2 diabetes, which is often related to obesity?
Dana, you want to take that one?
Sure. This has definitely been a theory for some time now. And in fact, there are people who are associating different nutritional and environmental factors with for the mother with changes in obesity in the offspring. And most people are looking at birth weight, but some studies now are following the children into infancy and later. And it appears that that the early origins or fetal origins of adult disease hypothesis that was popularized several decades ago may be holding up, and that the mechanism might be these epigenetic marks that are laid down very early.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back to this discussion of epigenetics on Please Explain, we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a message on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dr. Dana Dolinoy, Searle Assistant Professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences, School of Public Health at University of Michigan, and Dr. Randy Jertle, Professor of Radiation Oncology at Duke University. Our number, 212-433-9692. We are back with Dr. Randy Jertle and Dr. Dana Dolinoy. We're talking about epigenetics on today's Please Explain. We are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's go right to the first caller, Bill from Westbrook, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I had a quick question. I just read an article from Consumer Reports, and they were talking about the impact of the bisphenol A, if I'm pronouncing it right. And I have two children, a 3- and a 7-year-old, and we just got rid of their plastic water bottles that they use every day for school. It had that in it, and now those bottles are free of that chemical. But the article from Consumer Reports said that canned soup that kids consume in, you know, large quantities if you have young kids, have this chemical in the lining of the can. It's in Progresso, it's in Campbell's, and I was just wondering what your guests' thoughts are about the impact on kids long term.
Dana, this is a very appropriate for you.
Sure. Thanks for your question. I'm a mother of one, and I have one on the way, and I'm a scientist who studies bisphenol A and also very personally connected to it. Unfortunately, what you say is true. Bisphenol A is basically in two forms. The first is it's the building block for very hard plastic that's found in the baby bottles and water bottles. And you're right, it has been, because of consumer pressure, it has been removed from a lot of those products. But it is also made into a resin that lines most food and beverage containers, including soup containers. And it is especially important if the contents of the container are acidic. So it has been shown that bisphenol A can leach into the food. So whether the amount of bisphenol A that's leaching into the food is problematic is yet to be determined. And there are several health and science and regulatory agencies in the United States who are trying to investigate that right now.
Thank you for your call.
Okay, thank you.
We go now to Sue from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm very curious if there's any evidence or research being done to indicate that meditation can positively affect epigenetic changes for both physical and mental illness.
To my knowledge, nothing has been done to look at that yet, but I think it might be possible that epigenetic changes are occurring. There's people up in Canada, for example, have been working with nurturing behavior right after birth, for example, that definitely alters the epigenome. So it's possible that things like that do also alter the epigenome. We just don't know.
Along these lines, Wendy in Brooklyn asks, you've talked primarily of physical factors affecting the genome, diet, toxins, etc. What about environmental factors that are primarily behavioral and emotional? For instance, can chronic exposure to abuse, emotional or physical, during development affect gene expression?
That's now been looked at, actually, again, by the same people, Moshe Shift and Michael Meany up at McGill University, and there they have clearly shown epigenetic changes have occurred in abused children compared, and these are children now that in their late, I think, teens committed suicide, and then they have people that committed suicide that were not abused as children, and then people that died, unfortunately, and these are all males, in car accidents, and clearly showed that the children that were abused had altered methylation profiles, et cetera, important genes, and they were looking in the hippocampus of the brain.
Well, how did they even find out that you have this these alterations?
Well, you go in, and for example, they were looking, one type of thing was RNA levels, and they were looking at the genes that give rise to these RNA species. Mm-hmm. And they found that the promoter regions, for example, had a lot more methyl groups on the DNA than normal. And the same thing, the other one is a glucocorticoid receptor, so that we're looking at it in the hippocampus, and that is from stress responses. And they clearly showed, again, that there was major alterations in those promoter regions of that receptor. So there's pretty good evidence that there are epigenetic changes occurring. Whether that's giving rise ultimately to behavioral changes, et cetera, later on in life, we don't really know. This field, again, is just beginning. But I think it gives you an idea that environment means a lot of things to a lot of different people. For us, it tends to be more the environment, this chemical environments, but there's nutritional environments that we've worked with, radiation environments, and now we're talking about nurturing environments. And it's possible that all of these environments are ultimately impinging upon the genome, the genetic material, through alterations in the programming, in other words, the epigenome.
And we're going to put Anita on the line. I think her question is follows this train of thought. Hi, Anita.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for letting me come on and ask my question about electromagnetic fields and the increasing proliferation of these fields and putting children down at computers, which have a lot of games on them, which also emit electromagnetic fields.
I don't know of any data that's been generated looking at the role of electromagnetic fields on the epigenome. They said, we're starting to work with low doses of ionizing radiation. Dana, do you know of any studies at all?
No, I don't know of any offhand, but it would definitely be an interesting thing to consider.
And we thank you for your call. We go now to Lisa from Jersey City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. It's Lisa from Jersey
Lisa,
City.
Hi.
Hi. My question is about breastfeeding and skin-to-skin contact. So lots of studies have shown that not breastfeeding babies' breast milk, increases their chance of obesity and diabetes and things like that. And there's positive studies related to skin-to-skin contact with infants. Have there been any studies linking these to the epigenetics?
Dana?
Another great thing to consider. I'm not aware of anyone who's investigating that right now.
But it sounds to me that because epigenetics is a fairly new field, there's an awful lot of stuff to be studied.
Sure.
And how much of a growth has there been in this area? Are we starting to see more and more people get involved?
Oh yeah, I mean it's an exponentially growing field, and the way we look at that is the number of papers that are published in the field, and we're now in that extremely rapid vertical rise of interest in papers published. So it's growing tremendously rapidly, making it actually pretty darn difficult for an individual to even predict what we're going to be doing 1 to 2 years, let alone 10 years from now in this field. But there's no doubt that this field is a very, very rapidly growing field, and I think it's because people are really realizing that it's so incredibly important to our health and welfare.
Well, we became interested in the subject when we were talking about identical twins recently,
right.
And it dawned on us that because people do change over the years, that this had to be an area that scientists would be interested in, and we were surprised that it's only been fairly recent that scientists have started studying these things.
Well, one of the reasons why it takes time for things to occur, you can say, well, why hasn't this happened 20 years ago? We didn't have the tools 20 years ago. The epigenome basically is a program, and it's layered on top of the genome. So until the genome was totally sequenced in humans and other models, we really, really couldn't readily study this. Then you add on top of that that you've got, yet now with the epigenome, you've got in effect a fifth base, which is that methylated C that Dana was talking about. It's very difficult to sequence those things directly, but the tools are now becoming available. So as I'm saying, in the next couple of years, we're going to be able to do things that are infinitely more rapid and more in-depth than we can even possibly even think about right now.
We're talking about epigenetics on today's Please Explain with Drs. Randy Jertl and Dana Dolinoy. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Laurie from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering what environmental factors they feel may be contributing to the rise in autism, and also when do those factors make an impact? Is it before the baby was conceived, as in something the mother was exposed to, in vitro or within the first year of life?
Those are all really great questions. The answer to, I can give you, this, we don't really know. But my, again, this is a bias, so take this sort of with a grain of salt. I think these genes that we were talking about way in the beginning that are imprinted are going to play major roles in a number of neurological disorders. And they are regulated epigenetically. In other words, the copy that is silenced epigenetically. And I think we're going to start seeing that many of these are inappropriately expressed during development, and that that's going to give rise, as I said, to a number of neurological problems. The problem we have right now, though, is we don't know what the total repertoire of those genes are, and even worse, we don't know what the regulatory elements are for these genes. But that information is going to become available in a very short period of time because of these new tools that I was talking about. So some of these problems that seem like they're just not going anywhere very rapidly are going to move incredibly rapidly, I think, once we start looking at the potential for epigenetics and epigenetic problems causing these, rather than always focusing our attention on mutations in the genome.
Well, since these things are inheritable, should we assume that when we see suicide running in families that it may very well be because of some epigenetic alteration somewhere down the line?
I'm going to answer the question by going back to my analogy again. I don't want to downplay the importance of mutations. They're definitely important because I often ask what's more important, the genome or the epigenome. And I said, okay. I said, if you think of the genome as being like the computer and the epigenome being comparable to software, and I hear you're typing on the computer right now, what to you is more important, the computer or the software program you're running? It's a non-answerable problem or question. And I think in some respects it's the same here. Genetic and epigenetic problems are going to be involved in all of these disorders and diseases. But I can also then address and ask another question. If you have a problem with your computer, is it usually a problem with the hardware? In other words, the hard drive breaks or there's a chip that goes out, or is it a software problem? And the vast majority of the time, it's a software problem. And I think the same thing is going to be true in us, that many more problems are going to occur because of alterations in the epigenome than in alterations in the genome.
A listener writes, we have been talking a lot about what the mother is exposed to during pregnancy, but do the father's epigenetics also influence the epigenetics of the offspring?
Dana, I would like you to answer that maybe from the standpoint of Michael Skinner's work.
Sure. I mean, it is definitely a less studied question, but that doesn't mean that it's less important. So, yes, it does appear that that paternal exposures or exposure to the father can be inherited, although we just don't know as much about it as the mothers. The work done by Michael Skinner out in Washington State University has shown in a rat model that the epigenetic changes are only inherited through the father's germline or through the father's line. So, yes, it's definitely been shown in animal models, but I don't know of any conclusive evidence in humans yet.
Okay, let us go now to Amy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if someday we might have epigenetic analyses done the way we have genome analyses done now for susceptibility to diseases and what the implications of that might be.
I think it's going to be possible to do that, but it's going to be a lot more complicated because we have one genome, so you can look at mutations and you only have to look at it once. But we have probably somewhere between 250 and 300 different cell types. Every one of those cell types has a different epigenome, and we know clearly that the epigenome is changing with time. So it's not going to be as easy to predict what's happening and what's going to happen by looking at the epigenome, because there's so much greater variety in it than we have in our genome, obviously.
Now, a listener from Austin, Texas, Estelle, asks, can environmental factors cause a BRCA mutation? I guess the answer is, I'm getting from all of this, is sure,
yeah.
Maybe.
And it could happen spontaneously, too, but that's a mutation to the genome. That's not a change in the epigenome, the programming of the expression of that gene.
And listeners are calling about cancers in general. I'm assuming that they may be a factor in all cancers.
Yeah, and I mean, again, getting back to these imprinted genes, I think the imprinted genes tend to be genes that are positive or negative growth factors. And as I said, they are regulated epigenetically. And thus far, a large number of them are already known to be involved in cancer. My guess is that if and when we ever do know the complete repertoire of imprinted genes within us, that they probably are, the vast majority of them are going to be involved in cancer, one type or another. So they play major, major roles in cancer formation. There's little doubt in my mind that that's true.
Now, is the epigenome in liver cells different from the epigenome in brain cells?
Yes, and I mean, the reason why a brain cell looks different and does do something different than the liver cell is because its epigenome or its program is very different. So, and again, going back to the analogy of the computer, it's like I have two computers, and they're the same computer, but in one of them I've got Word running on, and the other one I've got Excel running in it. And so the program is different, and that's why those cells do different things because, in effect, in our cell, we have a programmable computer.
We have just 10 seconds left, but has the epigenome been mapped the way the human genome has been mapped?
No, but money is now being put into it, and I'm sure that there will be much, much more money coming into this field because, as far as I'm concerned, I think in many other people, biology and biological research in the future is going to basically involve
epigenetics. Thank you both so much, Dr. Randy Jertl and Dr. Dana Dolinoy. We've been talking about epigenetics on Please Explain today.